We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Now, for some people, the counterculture movement of the 1960s was all about changing society through political activism and through politics. At the same time, there were others who believed that it was technology, appropriate technology, small technology, that would be the thing to change society. And in some very interesting ways, that belief helped to fuel the digital revolution that we're living with and through today. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Fred Turner from the Department of Communication at Stanford University. This is something that he has written about and will be talking about in a talk that he'll be giving today on the U of I campus. It's titled Designing for Democracy in the American Counterculture, and it is part of an initiative sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus. It's their initiative for 2009-2010, Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. So people who are on the campus, if you'd like to hear Fred Turner, you can do that. He'll be speaking at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. Also, if you're interested in reading about this subject, he's written a book, and you can look for that book. The title is From Counterculture to Cyberculture, Stuart Brand, The Whole Earth Network, and the Rise of Digital Utopianism. That's published by the University of Chicago Press. So you can seek out the book if you'd like to read about this in some greater detail. As we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And you may email your questions, and it will help us if you keep them brief, but you can certainly email to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, folks who are listening are certainly welcome to jump into the conversation. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, David. Really nice to be here.
I think this is a very, very interesting story, and one I know that you said surprised you a little bit. Maybe the place to begin is, again, to explain sort of the background, that you had written a book before this. It was a book about attitudes toward Vietnam and the Vietnam War. Came out, say, in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And this was when you were actually had been a journalist. You were,
right,
were working at the Boston Globe out on the East Coast. And then you decided that you maybe wanted to change what you were doing. Mm-hmm. You went to California to go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that that is a theme that you see in the first book has to do with the way people think about or thought about maybe now what we would call information technology. Mm-hmm. Sort of one kind of set of ideas. And you explain that when you got to California, you were seeing all these sort of countercultural types, and that their attitude towards computers was stunningly different. It completely turned around what those kinds of people had been thinking before.
Right.
So let's sort of talk about these two visions.
So it really hit me very hard when I hit California. I arrived in 96, and I found a copy of Wired magazine. And Wired, you'll remember, was the mouthpiece for all things utopian there in the late 1990s and for the internet. And on the cover of Wired magazine was a picture of the globe as a smiley face with a giant daisy dripping out of its mouth. And the collision of 60s symbolism just blew my mind. You know, the last time I remembered seeing a daisy in that way was in that beautiful picture of the blonde-haired young man slipping a daisy into the barrel of a gun at the 1967 March on the Pentagon.
Yeah.
So this really surprised me. What was all this 60s iconography doing there? And why were people beginning to imagine computers as tools for social liberation? Right smack in the middle of this was a guy named Stuart Brand, who founded the Whole Earth Catalog, perhaps the seminal publication of the counterculture. And you know, it astonished me to see him celebrating computers, because when I had done the Vietnam book, computers were the symbol of everything everything about the Cold War military state that we wanted to fight against. To give you a concrete example of that, in 1964 in the Free Speech March at Berkeley, people hung Hollerith cards, which are those old computer cards, computer punch cards, around their necks and said, I am a human being. Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. I don't want to be information. I don't want to be associated with information technology. I don't want to be monitored. I don't want to be part of the state. So I got really curious. What changed? Why was it that counterculturalists seemed to be embracing the same technology that was once the technology of the state against which they marched? Mm-hmm. And that became the center of the book.
Yeah. Well, what you do is you go back and look at two sort of streams within the counterculture, left-wing political activism, mm-hmm. you know, going back to the time around Vietnam. And you identify these two streams, the ones that I just very briefly hinted at in the introduction. That is, those people who were interested in direct political action. They said, that's the way we're going to change things. So they had protests and they marched, and that was their thing. Then there was another group of people who said, no, that's not going to change.
So this completely surprised me. I mean, when I went back to the 60s, I thought the counterculture was a single unified youth movement against the war, pro-LSD, pro-marijuana, you know, sort of, you know, march during the day, get high at night. I thought it was a unified world. And in fact, when I started interviewing folks associated with it, I found that there were two very distinct groups and they really disliked each other. And this hit me hardest when I interviewed Stuart Brand, who is the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, and I also interviewed Todd Gitlin, who was one of the leaders of Students for a Democratic Society. And let's just say there was a high degree of mutual antipathy. And it dawned on me that these were really quite different social worlds. And one way to distinguish them would be to make the distinction between Berkeley and San Francisco. In Berkeley, you did politics to change politics. You formed parties. You formed Students for Democratic Society. You had meetings. You had marches. In San Francisco, you thought politics were relatively bankrupt. What you did was you turned inward and turned toward consciousness, technology, and the hope for a kind of shared mindset and tried to build new kinds of communities around that. So one other thing, you know, something we've all forgotten, I think, is that between 1966 and 1973 was the largest wave of communal activity in all of American history. Somewhere between 2,000 and 6,000 communes were founded in that period. This was an enormous movement designed to step back from what looked at the time to be a bankrupt American political world and step into a new way of being together, a way built around shared mindsets, around communication, and around small-scale technologies like drugs and other things, stereos, that would help you achieve that shared consciousness. It was really an attempt to build a different kind of world.
Yeah, and these people, the people who were involved in this movement, the communalists, were the people that the Whole Earth Catalog was created to serve. And it was sort of an interesting concept, although it's one now probably we're used to. And for people who remember it, it's not a catalog in the way that the Sears catalog is a catalog.
In fact, you couldn't buy anything through it.
You couldn't buy anything from it. The idea was, though, that it was an aggregator. Uh-huh. You know, it was the idea of bringing together sources that then people would use that and say, okay, if I want this, I go here. And if I want this, I go over here.
Right. And so I've argued in print at some length that the Whole Earth Catalog is a prototype in many ways for the web. And that's very specifically true. Alan Kay and others at Xerox PARC actually used the Whole Earth Catalog as an interface design model when they were designing the laptop and other computers. But the Whole Earth Catalog was what was called at the time an access device. People wrote in, described small-scale technologies that they thought would be useful for the readers. They would be paid $10 if their item was used. And you got a description of the item and then instructions on how to get it for yourself. So the catalog was really a linking device. The other thing that I think was really critical about the catalog was that it became a map of the commune world that was springing up across the United States, because everyone that wrote in was from that world in one way or another or linked to it. And so when they wrote in and the catalog was published, you bought not only a map of products, but a map of the different communities within which those products were being used. Finally, you also bought into a notion of technology as a transformative thing, right? So you could buy small-scale stuff in this catalog, or at least find it through it. But the stuff wasn't just to help you do things. Let me give you an example. If you're headed back to the land, what do you think you need? Well, you probably think you need a backhoe and some serious farming tools. Not in the catalog. Instead, what's in the catalog? Books on cybernetics, books on geometry, books on the human body, books, books, books. Because in the catalog and for its communalist audience, what mattered most was not the mechanics of building a new community, but rather the mindset of building a new community. They wanted small-scale technologies for consciousness change, and they developed in the catalog a technology that served that purpose very well and served very much as a prototype for what would follow in computing.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I think is really interesting about this is that I'm sure that people have this idea, if you think of communes and the communal movement and all of this, mm-hmm. as being something that was a very back-to-nature kind of thing to capture a new simplicity. We're going to live on the land. Uh-huh. We're going to live the way the Native Americans did. Uh-huh. We're going to have teepees and all this kind of stuff. And that, in fact, maybe it had some elements of that, and yet it was certainly not anti-technological.
Right.
It was actually a different sort of thing than maybe that stereotype would lead us to believe.
So I was surprised to discover that the generation of 1968, that is to say people who were 20, 25 years old at that time, had been born immediately after World War II, and they had a really split idea about what technology was good for. On the one hand, they had grown up in the shadow of the nuclear bomb, right, the shadow of the atom bomb, and there was a terrible fear that large-scale military technology could literally wipe out the planet. And, you know, you certainly wouldn't want to grow up to be someone living in that world or the kind of adult that might bring that world into being. On the other hand, they had also grown up alongside the rise of amazing consumer technologies, automobiles, the record player, the portable record player. Imagine the sudden ability to take a record player into your room as a teenager, close the door, and dance while mom and dad yacked downstairs. I mean, that's really something to be able to do. So this generation wanted to reject the large-scale military technologies that had brought us, among other things, the possibility of nuclear warfare and the Vietnam War. But they didn't want to let go of the very great consumer technologies that they had grown up with and that had helped them imagine a new kind of freedom. And in many ways, I think, on communes, people embraced the kinds of small-scale technologies for change, even as they rejected large-scale technologies. And that was the bargain that they struck with the sort of dual enticements and threats posed by technology after World War II.
Yeah. Well, did they spend a lot of time thinking about or debating which technologies were okay that they would want, mm-hmm. and which they weren't?
It varied a lot by commune. So on some communes that was absolutely the case. On others, not so much. It really varied a lot. I was surprised on the communes that I studied how conservative they were. Really and truly, gender relations were often enormously conservative. You know, men were men, women were women. Lois Brand, Stuart Brand's first wife, said when they went out to a commune, Stuart would go out with the men and they would all have important conversations. Meanwhile, Lois and the women on the commune, you know, dressed in those wonderful long ankle-length paisley skirts as if they were frontiers women, would put bleach in the water to keep people from getting sick. You know, very conservative world, much, much more conservative than you would think. But the debates about particular technologies raged depending very differently on the different kinds of communes.
Yeah. Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. We're talking with Fred Turner. He is Associate Professor of Communication at Stanford University. We're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, From Counterculture to Cyberculture. The subtitle is Stuart Brand, The Whole Earth Network, and the Rise of Digital Utopianism, and University of Chicago Press is the publisher. He's here visiting the campus, and we'll be talking about some of these same ideas in a talk this afternoon. It's part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for this academic year, 2009-2010, Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's come forward a little bit. We were talking a little bit about Stuart Brand and about the Whole Earth Catalog. Mm-hmm. He also, and some other people too, mm-hmm. were very much involved in starting what I guess, as a matter of record, is what is described as being the first online community.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite an astonishing story, actually. In 1985, Brand and others were deeply distressed. They had come to feel that their efforts during the counterculture had failed, that American society hadn't changed. They were very much at wit's end as to sort of what to do for a living. And in 1985, Brand was approached by a guy named Larry Brilliant, who would later work for Google, to build an online computer system and essentially put the Whole Earth Catalog online. And Brand said, well, let's not do that, but let's create a conversation space using that same technology. And that conversation space became the Well, the Whole Earth Electronic Link. Now, it was not, in fact, the first virtual community, but it was the first place where the words virtual community were routinely used to describe what was going on. And, you know, one of the things that astonished me was going back and reading their archives, all their conversations were archived, and seeing that they were speaking in a kind of communal language. They had ported a lot of the ideals from the commune world of the 1960s directly into their behavior in the online world of the mid-1980s. But the world had changed around them. Suddenly, they were working in a high-tech world where people were hunting work all the time, and all of the networking skills and consciousness orientation of the counterculture suddenly had a utility that it didn't have before.
Yeah. So, and sort of the ultimate point where we get to and the point we are now is you really make the argument that he and a lot of these other people that you talk about in the book are very much responsible for the ways in which we think about these machines now and what we do with them. The fact that we think about the computer as personal, that there is this idea that there is something called cyberspace and it's a social space which can be inhabited, and that in fact that this is the, you know, where is the new frontier? It's there.
Right. No, and in fact, the community that I trace in the book actually developed the terms personal computer, electronic frontier, and virtual community. You know, core concepts that by which we understand where we are with regard to computing now. And it's sort of an astonishing group.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers, and let's talk with the first. And I think that would be in Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, back in the early to mid-80s, I subscribed to a magazine, the Coevolution Quarterly.
Oh, wonderful.
Which was, that was just so good.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I know it very well. So Coevolution Quarterly was where Stuart Brand went after he closed down the Whole Earth Catalog in 1972.
Right, right.
And it was a spectacular magazine, and it was a quarterly, ran for more than a decade, and it was through that magazine that Brand began to build the networks that became so important during the computer era.
Right.
So Kevin Kelly worked there. Kevin Kelly would later be an editor at Wired magazine. Howard Rheingold worked there for a while, who was the first person to ever use the term virtual community in print. And in fact, as I remember it, Coevolution Quarterly was the first journal in which the words virtual community were in fact used in print.
Yeah, I saw an interview with Stuart Brand, and he said something like, well, we got into computers because we had taken all the drugs we could, and that was the next logical step.
Well, so the actual story is a little more complicated than that. I'm happy to report, I think, that I'm the first person to read Stuart Brand's diaries besides Stuart Brand. As far as I know, and I read through that period, and he retells the story as exactly that, as computers replaced drugs as tools for the transformation of consciousness and community, and it makes a very neat package. But if you actually go back and read his diaries or talk with him at length, what you see instead in the early 80s is a fairly lost person and a fairly lost generation, a generation for whom the pursuit of consciousness as a means of social change really had failed. The counterculture really didn't change things. On the contrary, it fed directly into new modes of consumerism and new modes of technology development. And people in the 80s, in the early 80s, in the Reagan era, former counterculturalists, were really struggling to find meaning. So I think Brand very directly rewrote his experience of turning toward the computer as an extension of the ideals that he had in the 60s, partly as a way to preserve those ideals in a world where they had come to seem like maybe they weren't working out.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the reason that the communal movement eventually failed and came apart, was it that people were just disillusioned, that they felt that somehow that what they thought the goal was, they just hadn't gotten there?
So this is a great question, and this is what I'm going to talk a lot about this afternoon. You know, for people on communes, there was and not all communes, but many, there was a tremendous faith that you could design your way into a new kind of politics. You could escape politics. You didn't need to negotiate. You didn't need to work with people who are different than yourself. What you needed to do was find others of a like mind, hunker down together, and hope for the best. That doesn't work very well. The communes that survived were either very religious or very authoritarian in other ways. Most communes dissolved within 3 years. By 1973, most had disappeared. design is a terrible way to do politics. You need to do politics to do politics.
Okay. I want to bring in another person and another name. I'm not so sure how much he comes up in counterculture to cyberculture, but I know it's someone that you're interested in and I think that you're going to be talking about today, and that's Buckminster Fuller.
Yes, indeed.
Tell what interests you about him?
So Buckminster Fuller is a wild character. He's an autodidact, a polymath. He's the developer of the Buckminster Fuller Dome. He patented the geodesic dome. He did not invent it, though he claimed to. He simply patented it. He created the most dominant form of housing on the communes and at the same time one of the most dominant forms of government-sponsored housing for military projects in the 1950s, the dome, and a series of other things. Fuller is important to the counterculturalists because he has the idea of something called comprehensive design. He says, look, you know, we live in an industrial world. We can't change that. But you have the opportunity as an individual to, what he said, valve the products of large-scale industry, transmute them from large-scale industrial goods into something that changes your local life. And in doing that, you redistribute the wealth of the industrial world and make the place a more egalitarian planet. That idea gets picked up very hard by Brand and others. I think it's not correct, but it's a solution to that generational problem I posed earlier. How do we get rid of big technologies or live alongside them and build a better world using small ones? Buckminster mm-hmm. Fuller offered the answer to that question.
Yeah. He's a really interesting character, was pretty flamboyant, pretty good self-promoter, a guy uh-huh. who I think he's interesting for his ideas, but at the same time, I think actually when you go and you look at them, you think many of them are wildly impractical, that they that on one level they don't make sense, and yet somehow as a package, they have great
right.
appeal.
Right. So Fuller wanted to do things like put a giant glass dome over Manhattan. He was always seeking to make enclosed, technologically driven environments and always saw technology as a solution to social problems. Like the communalists who would follow his example, he thought politics was essentially a bankrupt process. So what you had to do was design your way into a new world. And you know, that's an idea that permeates our lives today. That certainly I think that's what a lot of the folks at Google think they're doing today, is designing their way into a new world.
We're just about at our midpoint here. I have another caller I'll get right to. I do want to introduce again our guest, Fred Turner. He teaches at Stanford University. He's in the Department of Communication there. He's visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk, and I want to again give the details. He will be speaking this afternoon on the U of I campus at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum, which is on South Gregory in Urbana. This is part of an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study, Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. These programs are free, open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending should mm-hmm. feel welcome, so you can stop by. Also, if you can't do that, you might also want to look at Fred Turner's book, From Counterculture to Cyberculture, Stuart Brand, The Whole Earth Network and the Rise of Digital Utopianism. It's published by the University of Chicago Press and has a lot of the ideas that here we're
That's right.
talking about
yep.
This morning. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Another caller here, someone in Indiana. Line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Since I was one of those fellows that went through this period,
great.
Throw out a couple things and ask one question, how you would fit it into the picture you've drawn about the 60s. A week after the set-ins at Greensboro, I was on the streets in Chapel Hill getting my head beat by policemen. Later on, I got into the civil rights things pretty deep and also into the drug culture. I ended up doing 8 years inside the North Carolina Department of Corrections, which was a hell of a lot of fun. But where would you put the weathermen in all this?
Yeah, that's a great question.
I just
question.
Sort of like wanted to chip away at the general picture to sense get a very solid picture of what's going on. But at least I was involved with them. I had a buddy of mine who was president of SDS down at Chapel Hill at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time he came and he says, how can we disrupt things around here? And I thought, and I said, well, we can go down there to the computer center. I mean, it was mm-hmm. wide open. I mean, people walked through the damn thing, you know, mm-hmm. windows and stuff. It had the computers for Duke, North Carolina State, and Chapel Hill all mm-hmm. there in one place. I said, go in there and blow it up.
Yep.
And I remember he looked at me like I was some kind of hideous monster. Mm. Yet he was a fellow out you wanting to blow up math buildings in Wisconsin and stuff like that. I never did get that straight in my mind why he took that attitude about that. Perhaps because he was at home, so to speak. Mm.
Well, let me.
Would you say something about the weather measure?
Yeah, no, I'd be delighted to. And I want to note before I get into it that Bernadette Dorn actually hid out, a former weatherman, hid out for a long time in the houseboat community where Stuart Brand lives. It's a famous place for counterculturalists. So in my view, the weathermen are and other like-minded groups were the most extreme versions of the new left vision. So I divide the counterculture for analytical purposes, between the new left and the new communalists. The new left are folks who want to do politics to change politics. The new communalists are folks who turn toward design, technologies of consciousness, step away from politics, and want to build communities around shared states of mind. On the new left side, I would argue that the weathermen are the most extreme version of doing politics to change politics. In their view, party politics, sort of negotiation sit-ins, just aren't working. And so you have to turn toward essentially military action to make change. And you're absolutely right that computers were targets of that action in that period. At the AI lab at MIT, the artificial intelligence lab, there was actually bulletproof glass. And you know, I actually had an office at MIT before I moved to Stanford in the library building. And the library building is a funny building there, one of the buildings at the business school. It has a big central core that's sort of unused. And you know, one day I asked somebody, so how come we have all these offices around the edge of the building and there's all this unused space in the middle that we can't even get into? And they said, oh, well, actually, that's a protective bunker-like area for the computing system that used to be there. Computers, particularly at MIT but elsewhere as well, were bunkered in, locked down, and protected from what many assumed would shortly be terrorist attack, precisely because they were seen as the symbols and tools of the military state against which young folks and others were rebelling.
Yes, that amazes me. I didn't know that about that. In the 70s, I was inside and never saw anything except rhythm and blues and country western music. So I know very little about that history. But I remember amazed when I walked into the computer room. I looked around. I mean, there were two people in there, you know. It was a little huge room with everything rolling. It was, you know, a Hollywood set up. It was beautiful.
What amazed me about those rooms,
amazed me that nobody had thought about somebody coming here, punching a couple of keys in three universities down
yeah,
on the knees.
That's right. That's right.
In my mind. And I didn't want to do it because I already had enough trouble with the civil rights thing and thought my SDS buddy could work that out. And he looked at me like I was crazy as hell, went on doing his marches and, you know, getting his head beat to death and all stuff like that. And I'll hop off. Nice program. Really nice. Took me way back.
Thank you.
Right. Well, again, I guess that really makes this interesting point about how the way we think about the computer changed from this point where it was this giant, overwhelming, sort of monstrous tool of the military corporate complex to this friendly thing that everybody has sitting on their desks and you can put it in your pocket.
So let me press this point hard. I don't think that computers are any less the tools of the military industrial complex today than they were in that period. Mm-hmm. What's changed is how we think about them. Computers have been imbued with the ideology and the beliefs of the American counterculture in a way that's so powerful that it has actually come to obscure many of the parts of computers that continue to do the work that mainframes did in the 1960s. You know, my work online is tracked. You know, Stanford University, you know, I once asked the computer guy who was installing my new machine in my office, you know, so do you guys track my keystrokes? He said, well, no, but, you know, if you download files using BitTorrent, we'll come by. Now, that means that somehow my employer knows that I might or might not be downloading files using certain kinds of systems and not others. So there's monitoring going on. You know, other systems are perhaps even less clear. Like online dating is really interesting. To use an online dating system, it seems like an area of free choice, seems like an area of free expression, and yet to be able to use it, you need to register, you need to provide enormous amounts of information, and you need to configure your own identity in a way that's presentable in computerized terms. Mm. And, you know, this is partly why folks doctor their photographs and reduce their ages. And that's something that computers are still doing to us that they were doing back then, but for which we've sort of lost a language of critique.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think about the caution that I don't know when it was, sometime back, that I heard, and I'm sure a lot of people heard, this caution that says when you're doing something online, you should assume that somewhere somebody is watching what you're doing. And I think that we've become so caught up in the convenience of these machines and what doing things online will enable us to do and having fun with them and you know, they become such an indispensable part of our life that part and the privacy angles and the things that we end up giving up in exchange for these other, you know, arguably positive features, we forgot about all the negatives.
Absolutely. And I think we've fallen for one of the fantasies that drove communes. And the fantasy is that we can escape politics. You know, that big powerful institutions don't have to bother us if we stay with people like ourselves, if we stay alone in our room with our machines. It's just us and our machines, right? It's just us and our consciousness. Well, no. The state is there. Large corporations are there. Your machine was designed by a large corporation. Sites like Google are advertising to you and collecting information about you. Other sites are reselling that information. You are in a public space when you are sitting at your desk at home alone in your room with your computer. I'll give you an example. In class, I once took my daughter's Facebook page, she's 14, and I threw it up on the screen in class. I'm a friend of my daughter on Facebook, partly so I can watch her Facebook page, see what she's doing. My 100 students were just horrified. They very nearly threw things at me, and they said, "You violated your daughter's privacy." And I was horrified in turn. Facebook is a corporately owned site. They reserve the right to keep everything that you post there. It's entirely public in the sense that I understand it. And I thought the confusion that my students had about what was public and what was private was a legacy of the countercultural turn that we've been talking about.
Yeah. And I also think it's interesting that within the, you know, the community of people who use computers and deal with computers, and even I think maybe at the consumer level, there still is this notion that that there are maybe two streams there, one that's the hardcore corporate and one that's the rebels. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm a Mac user, so so I'm cool with Apple. And yet at the same time, I'm not really sure that there's particularly the Apple people. I think they like to continue to promote this rebels kind of thing. But
the great irony about Apple, I get a big kick out of Apple. Yes, they have absolutely co-opted the countercultural rhetoric. Their 1984 ad is a legend. But they retain some of the most locked down code on the computing planet. You know, it's much harder to hack a Mac than it is to hack a PC. I'm also a Mac user. I love them. They're beautiful machines. But they're not countercultural machines.
Yeah. Let's take another call here. Line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Two things. One, I don't know whether the guest is aware of it or not, but in the mid-1970s, Champaign-Urbana was the center of a nationwide virtual community.
Mm-hmm.
You know about the Plato system?
I do know about the Plato system, yeah.
Okay, good. The other thing is, as a question, I'm really curious. I've been curious for a long time. I'm glad to have the opportunity to ask you. How is it that someone like Stuart Rand has become an advocate of nuclear power?
Yeah, yeah. So that's a great and disturbing question. So this is a part of Stuart Brand's career that I don't deal with so much in the book because I was so focused on his computing stuff. Stuart Brand has been an advocate, like Buckminster Fuller, for technology as the most efficient way of making large-scale social change quickly. So when Brand historically has seen large-scale social problems like global warming, he has, like Fuller, turned toward big technologies as a solution. This is not the first time. He has a kind of radical big tech streak that's can be a little bit scary. So it's nuclear power now. In the 1970s, you may remember, it was space colonies. Brand advocated the establishment of space colonies on satellites circling the Earth. And he was hardly alone in this. Congress actually gave money to support research in the area. Rusty Schweikert, an astronaut, testified before Congress on the feasibility of doing this. Brand published a book on the subject. And, you know, space colonies, nuclear power, for Brand, I think, those are examples of what Fuller described as comprehensive design, taking products designed for industrial purposes and repurposing them to save the human species. Now, whether you agree or not that nuclear power is a human species-saving kind of technology, I think is open for question. But I do think that's what he's trying to do.
I see. Well, I appreciate that explanation because, as you had explained earlier, Rand was an advocate of small-scale technology and very suspicious of the large-scale technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so this seemed very strange. And in fact, the space colonies things, in a way, could be conceived as benign because they don't particularly threaten anything, whereas nuclear power, of course, does.
Absolutely. And I'm a little less benign on the space colonies, only in that all of the technologies that went into them were derived from American missile and space exploration and were themselves military technologies. But you're absolutely right. This is one of the things that lurks behind the countercultural discourse on technology, a kind of faith that machines actually do what they're supposed to do. I remember Three Mile Island pretty well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have about 15 minutes left. In this part of Focus 580, our guest is Fred Turney. He is Associate Professor of Communication at Stanford University. He's author of the book From Counterculture to Cyberculture, Stuart Brand, The Whole Earth Network, and the Rise of Digital Utopianism. Some of the ideas that you will hear if you attend a talk that he'll be giving on the U of I campus this afternoon, 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. This is part of an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. And here, of course, again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Another interesting feature here, I think, is the way in which people like Stuart Brand and other people who came through this stream of the counterculture have now sort of buddied up with people who are politically from a real different part of the political spectrum.
So I was completely shocked when I was reading Wired magazine, which Brand and his network very much helped generate, although it was founded by other people. He was instrumental in its success. I was shocked to see in the late 1990s folks like Newt Gingrich on the cover and celebrated as heroes of the new social and technological revolution to come. And I was especially shocked because, you know, Gingrich was entirely anti-countercultural social styles, anti-drugs, anti-promiscuous sexuality, never mind his personal life. So how was it that a guy like Newt Gingrich could be in line with a guy like Stuart Brand? Well, I think the answer turns out to be that both of them distrust politics, though for different reasons, and both of them trusted technology as a way to make social change in the face of a bankrupt political system. Both also had enormous faith in the individual, perhaps for somewhat different reasons. I think, you know, Newt's version would be somewhat right-wing libertarian. Brand's version would be somewhat left-wing libertarian. But in both cases, I think they saw small-scale tech or just technologies more broadly and the individual and the corporate sector in particular as alternatives to a political system they believed was bankrupt.
Mm. Now, I wonder what you think about some of the debate that's going on about information technology and about the internet between people who still hold on to the ideal that this is indeed some kind of liberating technology and that while it does have downsides, if we just continue to let it rip, it'll get us where we want to go. That and those people who are saying, well, now, wait a minute. Let's just be a little bit more careful about where this is leading. And I think that particularly they're concerned with some of these notions of privacy that maybe we talked about a little bit earlier and said that maybe that it's not such a good idea if we just sort of let it rip and go wherever it's going to go and that we pull in on the reins just a little bit. And I wonder what you think about
that. Sure. Well, I think the thing to add – so I'm not a let it rip guy on this one. And I live in Silicon Valley where I'm surrounded by let it rip guys. So it would be easier to go that way. I think the key is to remember that technology is never a neutral device. Technologies are designed by and used in the context of corporations and states. Power doesn't go away. You may feel like it's just you pressing buttons, but the structure of the buttons and the context in which you can press them are being set by institutions that are part of your social world. Politics never goes away. And this is one of the mistakes that the communes made, is they thought they could escape them through a technology of consciousness. And so I think we retain the need to negotiate over the political uses and political importance of computing. I think we can see that in Google's experiences in China. I think we can see that here in the United States with Facebook. I think we can see it in a number of settings. There's very important work being done here in Illinois at the university by Lisa Nakamura and by Christian Sandvig on just this point. Really, really interesting stuff.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think about someone that I've talked with, and my apologies to you and him because I can't remember the name, but it was someone who had this really interesting way of talking about how people come to digital technology, mm-hmm. and the idea that for people of our age, that we're digital immigrants. Well, our children are digital natives because right. they were born into that, and we were not. So, right. and for I guess it makes me wonder about for our children and for people for whom this, you know, digital atmosphere is the water in which they uh-huh. swim, how to encourage them at least a little bit to think about its implications rather than simply just, you know, taking it for right. what it is and doing what they do and not really think so much about some of these larger questions about, well, what exactly right. does it mean?
Right. So I think the answer, I have a 14-year-old daughter and I care a lot about these issues. And I think that the main thing is, as in other aspects of parenting, you've got to stay very involved and you've got to not pull back from the technology because it's something that you don't feel that you understand or that somehow you're not native and therefore you've lost the right to regulate your child's behavior. On the contrary, when my daughter got her first computer this year, she was allowed to use it in her own room for the first time. Until then, we'd always kept the computer in the living room. And she got it with the proviso that I could and would go anywhere in her computer at any time. I would link to anything she did online, and I would monitor her closely. And I do that, and I remind her of this fairly regularly. Once or twice a week, I will go stand over her shoulder while she does her Facebook. I'll go online. I'll talk to her about what she's doing online. I think if parents in particular stay involved with their children and with their media use, they can continue to talk with them about it and be part of the process. I mean, just as you would help an adolescent child enter the world of sexuality, enter the world of relationships, enter the world of work, enter the world of driving. I think you need to help them enter the world of public computing.
Yeah. We have another caller here, a couple of callers. First in line is Champagne, and that's line number one, so we'll go there. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could comment on the open source community and how that pertains to counterculturalism in technology, because I know that a lot of the open source developers of the operating systems and software kind of consider themselves in that counterculture, and that they're building their own systems and designing their own software kind of against the grain of you know, big corporate Microsoft and Apple and whoever else.
Great. I can absolutely address that. First off, I want to say there's a wonderful book on just exactly that question by Christopher Kelty, who's a professor in Los Angeles. So open source communities grow in part directly out of opposition to mainstream computing. My favorite example of this is Richard Stallman, who tended the computers at the AI lab, the artificial intelligence lab at MIT, and went on to help drive open source development and come up with copyleft and other ideas. At the same time, though, I think it's important to remember that open source does not exist now in opposition to mainstream computing. On the contrary, it exists in a complementary relationship with it. Many firms give their employees a full day a week to go out and do open source programming because open source software has become part of mainstream software development. Apache, which is an open source based on an open source protocol, is the largest market share in server software out there. It's an entirely open source product. So open source now has become one of several modalities of doing commercial software. I want to say one other thing about open source software. Many people contribute to it, but relatively few people profit at a very high level from it. Linux is a very good example of this. Linux is an operating system that competes arguably with Apple and Microsoft systems. In the Linux system, many people contribute. Many people learn and enjoy and collaborate and form a sense of community around contributing, and I don't want to disvalue that at all. I think that's really important. At the same time, only certain subsets of that community have been able to take the software products that have been developed and remarket them and build firms around them in ways that generate multiple millions of dollars. So I'm very intrigued by not simply the countercultural mode of production, but also by the very different and differentiated ways in which people can take advantage of the value produced there. Everyone may be able to contribute equally, but not everyone is able to take from the pool equally at the other end.
Interesting. I completely agree with that. I'm involved in a couple of open source projects, and I know that, Apple systems are more or less user-friendly. So I find it interesting that you that you brought that up as well, and I was very interested in hearing your opinion on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, on to Champaign County for another caller. Line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I guess from some earlier parts of the conversation, I was reminiscing about the Iliac 4 story, which happened on the Champaign-Urbana campus, where the current astronomy building, I think it's still the current astronomy building, was built originally for housing this Iliac 4 computer, which was completely a DOD project, and it was opposed by the local New Left.
Mm.
And eventually, I think they didn't get their large-scale integration down small enough. I think it eventually went to San Diego, perhaps, but they didn't actually build it here. But I don't know if it was actually a victory by the opposition in any sense, and whether it would have actually made much difference anyway. But contemporizing this a little bit, the new IBM Deep Blue that's going up at the campus, it's a wonderful thing, a water-cooled supercomputer. It's going to be a big one. But what I worry about is, you know, the large corporate influence. And SAIC, Scientific Applications and International Computing, which is a very spooky outfit, 90% of their $8 billion in revenue comes from the government in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
They have a contract for something called Deep Green, which is a battlefield control mm-hmm. operating system integrated and probably integrates in the drones and the firing of Hellfire missiles and all that. And that's going on while we speak, and I'm fairly confident that new Deep Blue will be used with Deep Green, and then
it's
unsettling.
You've put your finger on a tension that I haven't figured out how to work through in my work, and I think is incredibly important. One of the things that's going on with the integration of computing and computing styles, some of which seem to be countercultural, is a real blurring of military worlds and commercial worlds. It's just very hard to see. I'll give a couple of examples from the different periods that I cover in my book. The 1950s, I always thought it was Cold War military research and very locked down. On the contrary, inside military industrial research, it's actually very, very flexible and very open. Many of the countercultural styles that you see in the 60s were, in fact, born in military research worlds in the 40s. You know, one of the first and most important people depicted in the Whole Earth Catalog is Norbert Wiener, who is a mathematician and, among other things, a military researcher during World War II. More recently, you see things like the ICT, the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California, which is a government-sponsored and university-sponsored joint project bringing together game designers from the game design world in L.A. So these are commercial game designers with soldiers and military applications designers. So game designers will help develop interfaces for military applications of the kinds that you just described, and they will also go out with soldiers, do training so as to develop games for the commercial sector, for young men who might themselves one day be asked to serve in the military, built around military applications. They want to make more realistic shooter games. I find that enormously disturbing. You know, my first book was about how Americans remember the Vietnam War. I spent 3 years interviewing traumatized combat vets. I worked in a VA hospital. You know, if you've seen what happens after a war, the last thing you want to do is see the technologies of war become available as toys in everyday life, and I think the blurring, the sliding back and forth between military worlds, commercial worlds, and everyday life is going on all around us, and it's very hard to track, and it's very important to track. So thank you for raising that.
All right, I have another caller here I want to go to, and this is someone in Urbana, so we'll get there. Line 1. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Hmm? Interesting subject. Also, the vicarious nature of war with drones and stuff is an interesting subject in and of itself because you're so far away from target.
Mm-hmm.
I spent 15 months in Vietnam, but I was going to ask you about the Internet in the sense of cloud computing. I've been writing fiction for the last few years, and I wrote mm-hmm. a short story about, I'd say, late last year about the idea that all this social networking and cloud computing is really just a mnemonic device because my doctorate was in a catacomb painting in Rome in 80 AD, and mm-hmm. so I spent a lot of time in ancient graveyards and stuff, and how people would leave these visual memories of themselves, paintings, you know, language and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. I was wondering if the Internet itself was becoming sort of a mnemonic device.
Yeah, that's a great question.
And well, that, in that far beyond our lives, the cloud computing analogy and massive storage, everything we do on the net will be stored somewhere and can be retrieved by people. So in a sense, it's like a reflection of you, your life. I mean, all these kids, I'm pretty old. I'm 60 years old, but all these kids literally live on the web. I mean, they upload things. Their lives are sort of on this sort of electronic media. But it's inadvertent. It's subconsciously. It's about, a remembrance of themselves.
So it's a great question. I want to make two distinctions. I think I tell my daughter, what goes on the internet stays on the internet. So turn off that webcam. And I think in the short term, you're absolutely right that memory, the 10-20-year framework, memory stays. In the long term, however, what we're discovering at Stanford, and there's a whole bunch of folks working on this problem, is that memory fades. Digital bits are exactly not like the columns of ancient Roman temples. Ancient Roman temples are made of stone. Stone stays whether the Romans do or not. Bits don't stay without the active maintenance of the computing systems in which they live. Bit rot is a terrible problem. At Stanford, for example, we do the history of gaming, online gaming. Well, to make online games available now, we have to have each of the machines that they were originally written for as well as the games themselves. So I would argue that the cloud is actually an inadvertent tool for forgetting at the cultural level, and that's a problem we have to confront.
Yeah. We're almost out of time. Maybe we have about a minute. One last thing I guess I wanted to ask you about was the digital divide and the various kinds of digital divides and whether, in fact, this technology breaks down divisions between people, or maybe the kinds of divisions and the kinds of communities people sort themselves into. It simply solidifies them and right. recapitulates them.
Well, it's a great question, and I think that, again, it's a countercultural problem. Many hippies believe that if you just dropped acid, you'd begin to feel your kinship with the folks around you. They neglected to note that the folks around them were already like them. They were predominantly young, predominantly white, predominantly college-educated, predominantly moneyed. I think the challenge that we face with computing, as with communities in the past, is reaching out to others unlike ourselves and finding ways to build communities across differences. Computers can help with that, but they're by no means a solution. That's a political problem that we need to keep working on in the political realm.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Fred Turner. He is Associate Professor of Communication at Stanford University. And if you're interested in hearing more from him, and you're here in Champaign-Urbana, you can hear his talk, Designing for Democracy in the American Counterculture, this afternoon at 4 at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. This is part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for 2009-2010, Interpreting Technoscience Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. And if you can't attend the talk and you'd still like to read more about the subject, you look for Fred's book, From Counterculture to Cyberculture, subtitled Stuart Brand, The Whole Earth Network, and the Rise of Digital Utopianism, University of Chicago Press is the publisher. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.